The following program is presented by the Nerdy Show Podcast Network, geeky programming for all nerds across the multiverse. All Nerdy Show programming is made possible by A Comic Shop, Orlando's number one comic shop and nerd destination, and with the generous support of listeners like you. For more Nerdy Show podcasts, community forums, and learn how you can support this and other Nerdy Show programming, visit nerdyshow.com.
What's going on, Flame On listeners? This is Pat, the Talking Bearskin Rug. We've got a very special episode for you today. We're bringing you not one, but two interviews with great LGBT creators who have put their projects up for backing on Kickstarter. First, you hear Brian talking to Jace Peoples of the Advocate magazine, one of the creative forces behind the new LGBT kids book, Square Zare Pair. Listen in.
Hi, this is Brian, and I'm here with Jace Peoples, the author of the new Kickstarter-based project, Square Zare Pair. I got it right. I was so worried.
No, you got it right.
So Square Zare Pair, I'll give the quick, and then you can elaborate. It's a great LGBT kids book that in a world where we have so few LGBT positive like children's stories and a gender identity stories, you have come along and have this great pitch. So I'll let you tell us your pitch, and then if anyone is interested, we'll mention this again later in the show. But it's up on Kickstarter. Square Zare. Zare is Z-A-I-R, and pair like a pair of people or a pair of anything. And that's how you can find it. So, Jace, take it away and tell us all about this cool new book that you're creating.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Brian. Square Zare Pair, it's an LGBT-themed children's book, like you said. It's written by myself with art by a brilliant former Disney interactive artist. Her name is Christine Knopp. And the story takes place in the magical land of Hanamadu. It's a place where square and round zares, small little creatures, called Zares, they do all things in pairs, and they live here. And the pairs are always made up of one round Zare and one square Zare. But one day when the two square Zares pair up for the first time, the village initially rejects them before learning a lesson in kindness and acceptance.
And now you pick this interesting sort of fantastic area, of course, to do like a great classic fairy tale. I from what I'm seeing of the art so far and from what I'm hearing about the land and all that, it feels very Seussian. Is that kind of where you were trying to aim for, or what was your influence there?
Absolutely. I grew up in the library. My mom was a librarian for the first 18 years of my life, and I spent a lot of summers going and spending hours and hours in a library during story time, and I really fell in love with Dr. Seuss. And I remember a lot of the animated specials that would come on when I was a kid. And so I wanted to create a story in the spirit of that that really represented the LGBT point of view and helped further diversity and, send the message that bullying isn't cool.
I mean, what's also magical is you paired up with this artist, Christina Knopp, which I don't think I had seen in any form, but she is former Disney, of course. And you go to her Tumblr, which is kikidoodle.tumblr.com. And oh my gosh, the art is just gorgeous. I mean, she has, of course, a lot of the Square Zare Pair, promo or just, concept design stuff. And it looks so much fun. Does she do everything? Pencils, colors, inks, the whole thing?
She goes through a really big process. As a matter of fact, we spent a year storyboarding out the book first, where she did very rough sketches, and she took it from there. But Christina is brilliant. She does a lot of make-believe animals, and she has a long history of creating her own characters. So when I found her and I saw her artwork, I knew that there was no better artist for the project than her, and I'm so thankful that she agreed to do it.
And it's just, I mean, again, the color, the mainly the thing is the colors. Like, the designs are really cool, and they're very much keeping in that they have a slight touch of Disney. They have a slight touch of Dr. Seuss. They have a slight touch of something else that I can't put my finger on, but definitely in that mold. But the colors, oh my God, the colors are brilliant and lovely, and like pinks and purples. And I mean, it's just visually arresting. That is the first thing. Like, I had heard about this for a mutual friend of ours, and I was like, well, yeah, of course we're going to talk to, you know, a new LGBT kids author. Like, this is awesome. And then I want to get into your background too, because, you know, you're a big geek like us at Flame On. So, you know, any gay geek out there who does something cool like this, of course I want to know more. But when I watched the video you posted and when I saw the visuals, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is going to really catch some attention. Plus the title is that great Seussian title, you know, with the alliteration or the internal rhyming or whatever. It's been forever, you know, like that really catches people's attention, right? You know, so what, so your background, and we'll come back to this, you know, you are a journalist from what I've been able to find out, and you seem to be pretty geeky. You have a lot of geeky articles to your credit. I may or may not have found some postings of yours from years back on bulletin boards. If it's the same Jace, I don't know. Tell us a little bit about your geeky pedigree, because I think our listeners would be really curious.
Wow. Okay. So part of my education in geek culture actually came from the years I spent in the library. When I was a young kid, they used to have comics in the library. And that was one of the first ways in which I learned how to read. I can remember distinctly picking up old World Finest comics and Marvel Star Wars run back in the day.
Yeah.
And I just fell in love with comics from there. I used to beg my mother to take me to the 7-Eleven down the street from where we lived, where I would spend hours, if I can get away with it, just going through the spinner rack of comics, and would run down to go pick up new issues of G.I. Joe and Justice League, anything I could get my hands on.
Now, were you more of a Marvel or DC guy back then, and who were some of your favorites?
Oh, definitely DC. I'm a huge Superman fan, and I actually spent many, many years protesting that Marvel altogether.
Oh, wow.
But I've since turned away from that, and I actually love comics and all the different companies and comics in all of its various forms. I just think it's a wonderful medium that's only just now beginning to get its proper due.
Oh, gosh. I mean, we're certainly in the renaissance of comic book culture, with it dominating the movies and dominating media. I mean, when Marvel or DC do anything big now, we get a freaking press release and it's all over all the major news outlets. Like, and it's awesome, too. I will admit, we've talked to Brian Anderson as well, who's written for Advocate. And like, I am thrilled, having been a longtime reader of the print Advocate from back in the day, that there is geeky coverage, because for the longest time, you know, and you, I'm sure, would agree, like us gay geeks would pick up Advocate or Out or Instinct or, gosh, X and Y. And it was really only some of the, like the X and Y and some of the younger themed gay media that would even touch geeky anything. And now it seems
we're getting great coverage. Absolutely. I'm the entertainment editor over at The Advocate. And since I stepped into that role, I've done my best, even beforehand, actually done my best to sort of up the range of geeky coverage that they provide. I've actually ended up working with DC Comics a lot and had the opportunity to break several stories. It's been an amazing, amazing position to be in. And I'm really happy to be able to help bridge the gap between the geekverse and the LGBT media side of things.
Now, have you had a lot of pushback in that attempt? I mean, has it been a pretty well received? And I'm guessing it's becoming an easier battle. But early on, I'm guessing it was a tough fight, right?
I think I'm stepping into it at just the right time.
Okay.
And whereas maybe 5 or 6 years ago, it may not have been as easy a sale, but because, as you said, we are living in a renaissance of superheroes and comics and geek culture. It's been fairly easy to convince them.
Now, in covering this, you know, comic book world and being a journalist, have you also thought about? Have you had story ideas that you've kind of tucked away? Would you be interested in pursuing that at one of the big publishers in the comic medium? Or is it, would you rather stick to, you know, outside of that, that sort of, you know, niche market? What would you, any, oh, well, I won't ask you for any ideas, of course, because those are, you know, protected for potential future use. But I mean, is that something you'd be interested in doing? Do you have a good Superman story in there?
Absolutely. I mean, that would be a dream come true. Definitely, there are always ideas kicking around. But as I've been moving along, I've been noodling over a couple of other ideas, and I would love to sit down and pitch them.
Yeah, I mean, because I know from going to many of the comic shows that I would love to see more geeky creators in the marketplace. You know, you only have so many Mark Andreykos and now Tony Orlando and Jimenez, Phil Jimenez, we're getting more and more Kate Leth. I mean, we're getting more and more of these great creators. And, you know, of course, our straight allies have a great ability to write queer content. I got to host a panel at Heroes Con, and they had the Hernandez brothers and my mind is blanking. Oh, it's Tony Moore. And I got to have both of them on the same panel at this same show. And it was so awesome just to be like, oh my gosh, you wrote queer content and you're not gay. You know, how did you do it? What did you, you know, what brought that to your attention? You know, what was your response? And, you know, they did it. Gosh, they did it when it was really not accepted or even interested and protested. And, you know, now, I mean, that we can have these queer comics now, you know, like Northwest, and we can have queer kids books besides just, you know, Heather Has Two Mommies, you know, like it's so awesome.
Yeah.
Kids are going to be able to grow up in such a more positive environment, you know, when they have that identity question and they have no, you know, outlet for it. So when you were younger, who were your either media or personal, like who were the gay or you thought they might be gay heroes for you?
I always thought it's been an interesting aspect of Superman, and I know a lot of other people might share this view too. I kind of grew up loving a lot of the young Superboy comics because as a kid growing up gay in a small town, I always felt like I looked like everybody else, but there was something different about me. And I think without knowing it, some of those writers really captured what that felt like, the idea that you are an alien on the inside. And all the silly excuses he would give Lana Lang about why they couldn't date and all these different things that he had to hide even from people that he cared about most really resonated with me as a gay person growing up.
Oh, I'm sure, right? And I never thought about that because I didn't read Superman growing up as much. I read a more Marvel, and so X-Men, of course, was like the everybody's, you know, that's the gay metaphor and the civil rights metaphor and all that. But, you know, even some stuff with Spider-Man, you know, and any superhero that had like that secret identity that they had to protect, like that definitely resonates with gay youth, I think, and transgendered youth as well. It's got to be a factor.
Absolutely. I think a lot of things in the 80s as well, a lot of cartoons like Gem and the Holograms and things like that that resonated with a lot of gay people. I think anything that had that dual identity where you had to hide that secret identity from other people that you love. I think a lot of queer people found a kinship with those characters, and that's part of the reason why they've grown to love them and they've stuck with them as long as they have.
Now with your, let's go back to the Square Zare pair, of course, you have some really interesting, reward levels. I had a hard time. I'll be honest. I had a really tough time choosing, but the one that really caught my attention, and I'm kind of sad that I just didn't have the money to go for it, is the Gem and the Holograms. Samantha Newark herself is doing your audiobook. Like, that is so cool. How did you, like, what gave you the idea to approach her? And, you know, like, how did that all come to be?
Samantha's amazing, and she's been somebody I've looked up to for a very long time. Of course, I grew up like many other kids watching Gem and the Holograms, and that voice to me is just the epitome of kindness and sweetness and everything that I felt was at the heart of Square Zare Pair. I met Samantha a few years ago. I've interviewed her a few times for The Advocate, and this last year at the Transformers convention, BotCon, she was a guest, and we sat down and had a nice conversation, and I reached back out to her about possibly doing this, and to my elation, she said yes. And so, yes, she's recorded the entire audiobook. It's already completed and ready to go.
I mean, that is so cool. Like, and you know, if you're going on here and you're looking at the levels, make sure you go all the way down to the one. It's $100 for, like, the audiobook plus the PDF plus the hardback, all of that. Like, that's a great, great deal because, I mean, this is – it's gem. And in an era right now where, unfortunately, we think the movie for Jim and the Holograms won't really give the cartoon its due. If I'm being polite here. I mean, we don't know because we just saw a trailer and, you know, I assume your reaction was similar to a lot of the fans of the cartoon when you saw it.
Well, I mean, it's definitely not the same Jim and the Holograms that we grew up with. Yeah. But I'm going to be interested to see how it turns out. And hopefully there will be some elements that are positive and make it a worthwhile venture.
I mean, I know she says in the trailer synergy, and so I'm like, well, maybe they're just not showing us certain elements, but certainly it's a more grounded, down to earth sort of, you know, chill, a YouTube era, you know, rise to stardom story. So you know, it's an adaptation. They're all adaptations, but I am interested to see the final product and see. Now, have you checked out the Jim and the Holograms comic book that's been out?
I have, and what I think is so cool about that is the way that they've reinterpreted some of the characters to be LGBT as well.
I saw that.
I think what's even more amazing about it is one of the creators is came out as transgender recently.
Have you watched, speaking of Jim, and then we'll get off to the Jim tangent here, have you watched the Sierra Enema, is that her name? The drag queens that do the voiceovers for Jim?
Oh, for Jizz and the Mammograms.
Yes! We just showed that to friends of ours, and their mouths were just on the floor. I mean, it's about the most offensive thing you can do with that cartoon, I think. But it is pretty funny.
Yeah. But it's amazing.
Yeah, it takes a lot of talent.
In a completely different way, it's amazing.
Exactly. So Sophia Campbell.
So the comic is
go ahead.
Yeah, it's Kelly Thompson and Sophia Campbell.
Okay.
Who are the current creative team on the Jim and the Holograms comic. And it's a departure from what we also knew in the 80s, but I think it's wonderful and well done, and everybody seems to be enjoying it. What's really cool is to see that Jim, on the eve of her 30th anniversary, is having a renaissance as well. And it is being interpreted in lots of different ways. And that can only mean more people that end up being exposed to the project and, you know, hopefully a larger fan base.
I mean, and the art design on this, like, it is equally very modern and influenced, but very true to the feel of the original in terms of the punk rock, you know, elements. So I'm very I was not as big a Jim fan growing up, but I certainly watched it occasionally, and I was like, oh, it's cool, I like this. And then, you know, since then, going back and kind of rediscovering some of it and just reliving that whole era of the 80s, because that was pretty much when I was in my formative years. And, you know, those kind of cartoons like Jim and G.I. Joe and, you know, that sort of style of animation is just very, well, now we look at it and we just think, wow, that's really quaint. But back then that was like the most amazing thing, you know, I mean, it was the best we had. And it still has that fondness, even if it sort of looks a little dated.
Yeah, I think there's a charm to it. And one of the things that I think kids don't really realize today is that was a golden age for animation on television in a lot of ways. It was the first time that we could come home from, you know, 1982 to, you know, throughout the rest of the 80s. It was the first time where we could come home after school and see these characters every single day. So I think that they impacted our generation in a way that isn't available to kids these days because everything is so saturated. But at the time, that was new and groundbreaking.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't think they even have any more, like, the concept of Saturday morning cartoons. You know, they're all over if you go to the right channels. But, you know, that event that we had you know, event of television every Saturday morning. It became such an institution tradition for multiple generations of youth. And yeah, now it's definitely different now.
I think that's also what creates culture. It's what creates pop culture. It's the idea of this event bringing us all together. So it became playground talk. It was the thing that we talked about, you know, when we saw each other the next day at school or the next week. And unfortunately, that there's not the same circumstances that create that anymore. They're different, but I'm really happy to have grown up in that time because we had something special. And that's a part of what I am hoping to sort of recreate with Squares Their Pair is this event, this thing that comes together for young LGBT people and their parents.
I mean, it's a great touchstone, and one of the pledges or the reward levels is actually for $500, five hardback copies of Squares Their Pair are donated to local libraries, which that's really special because, you know, these libraries are still a place where underprivileged kids or kids with parents who just want to kind of, hey, kid, you know, here, I'll take you to the library, as you know, is a great tradition. And they're there for resources. And, you know, that the kids could find these books in their schools and in their libraries, you know, wouldn't have to wait until they grow up to go online to find them or, you know, whatever. Like, that's awesome. And I'm sad here to see that, like, you still have – I mean, basically it's a limited number and you still have them left for people to do. Like, that's a great – not only is it a good – you know, you get a copy, but you get to donate those to the school. Like, I love that you put that in there.
Thank you. I actually I have a person that did donate that amount, but then they didn't choose any reward. So – I thought it was rather interesting, but we recently in this last week added a stretch goal on the campaign. And if we reach it, we wanted to donate a full set of books, one for each class plus two to the campus library to Harvey Milk Civil Rights Academy in San Francisco. And I wanted to do that for two reasons. One, just like you said, libraries have been a touchstone for or a cornerstone for young people and learning more about the world. And it was certainly a big part of my life growing up. But I also wanted to have a presence with the story in one of the cities that helped form the modern civil rights movement for LGBT people. And Harvey Milk Civil Rights Academy is located just a couple of blocks away from where Castro Camera was opened by Harvey Milk and his partner back in 1972, right there in the Castro district.
Wow.
So I'm really hopeful that we can push things a little bit further because I would love to be able to walk in there with a whole set of books to that place and bring a story that furthers love and diversity and kindness to a whole new generation.
Absolutely. I mean, it's so important for, we just had our Fringe Festival here in Orlando, a Fringe Theater Festival, and it's so important to have plays and media that have gay history and connect with the gay history. And the fact that, you know, there are these schools being named after people like Harvey Milk, and that to me is so important because we've seen how easy it is. People forget. You ask a lot of people, you know, slightly younger than us, I think, and Stonewall doesn't have really much resonance to them. Even Harvey Milk may or may not have resonance if they haven't either, you know, read gay history or watched the Milk, you know, movie or you know, just, you know, passed it on in, you know, in different forms. But like that these schools exist and that you want to help, you know, give them these resources, like that's, again, it's a great mission. You know, it's neat to create art, but it's even better when that's art with a message of hope and acceptance, and like, you know, the more of it the better.
Yeah, well, I kind of think it's our responsibility as well as LGBT people to help further not only our causes but our own history, because if we can teach others about what we've been through in our perspective and our own history, we help make the world a better place as well. And even for kids who aren't LGBT, by sharing these stories and by sharing our history, we help create better allies for the future as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and again, showing people like the theater projects that we saw about Stonewall, I knew people who had seen it who had no idea. And just witnessing these characters react to the events of Stonewall, like that meant so much to them because they just had no idea. You know, growing up, I didn't know about Stonewall probably until I was at least in college, and, you know, that there were riots, that there was an event where patrons of a gay bar basically said, you know what, police, we're not going to tolerate your arresting and harassing us anymore. I mean, that moment, and, you know, that it birthed the gay rights movement. It's just, yeah, it's very important history. And I'm glad to see you and other artists and writers that I know finding ways to bring that to, you know, the culture. Squares Air Pair, the Kickstarter, depending on when this goes out, may have closed, but hopefully you will have seen it on our Facebook, seen it on Twitter. We have other, of course, our friends at Geeks Out are promoting it. I don't know. I'm sure you've done other shows and podcasts about this by now. They're, I'm sure, promoting it. Like, we really, I know you're close, and hopefully by the time people hear this, you will have succeeded and you will have your Kickstarter goal met. I wish you the best of luck with this. I'm really excited to see this, to hold it. You know, I've already ordered my copy. But I'm really excited for people to check this out. The video is up on the Kickstarter page. Again, Square Zair, Z-A-I-R, Pair. And there's a great video. You know, you talk very, very eloquently about the whole mission, the whole thing. And it's a great pitch. The art looks great. I'm excited. Now, would you want to take this and do anything else with the idea in the future? Or do you feel like this was just a sort of nice package, one-shot thing? Is there something you could do, or it's just not the right thing to expand on?
Oh, no, I would absolutely love to expand on it. I mean, there's so many possibilities with that. But definitely, this is just an initial run and to get things moving along. And if it can gain enough attention, I would love to see it released on a broader basis.
Awesome.
I would love to see it picked up by a larger publisher. But still, I don't want to have somebody come in and take out the message of what's at the heart of it. And yeah. So I think it was important for me to stay in control of that message so that the LGBT heart of Squares Air Pair was kept intact.
No, that's, I mean, in this day and age with things like Kickstarter, with, you know, print on demand, with all of the tools we have, there is no reason you can't realize that dream without a major publisher to at least get the word out. And so I'm very excited for this. Again, if you guys have anything else, you know, questions about it, Jace, you're on Twitter as well.
Yes, I am. And I'm also on Facebook. And if people would like to see on YouTube, there is the first one third of the audiobook, along with some of the preview of the art the preview by Samantha Newark, the audiobook that she read, and the preview of the art by Christine Mupp, that is up on YouTube right now. And it's also available on our Kickstarter page underneath our updates.
Now, they would find you just with your name, Jace Peebles. Peebles? Sorry.
Yeah.
My B's and my P's get confused. Jace Peebles with a P, two P's. And then your artist is also up on Tumblr and DeviantArt and a couple of the places. Let me make sure I get her Tumblr right. KikiDoodle.tumblr.com. Christine Knopp is her name. And that's K-N-O-P-P.
Christine Knopp.
And again, her stuff is awesome. Very excited to see. Are you doing any of the cons or shows, or is this sort of a thing you would not really take to one of those just yet?
So Christine will have a table at Comic-Con, and she's a staple at a lot of conventions, including WonderCon. We may not have copies available by this year for Comic-Con, but there will definitely be artwork there. Christine will be there. I'll be roaming around the halls. there will definitely be some things available there.
Awesome. Well, please, everyone, go out and check this out. Support it, even if you just do the PDF. Every little bit, as I've found with these Kickstarters, really goes a long way. And I look forward to, like I said, getting a copy and sharing this with, I mean, I'm pretty much going to read it. I'll keep my PDF, and I'm going to hand like a hard copy to my nephew who's going to be born in October, you know, when he's old enough. You know, I'm going to definitely, this is the kind of thing you want to share and buy copies of to share with schools, which again is a great, great mission. So I wish you the best of luck with this project.
Thank you. We're super pleased to let everybody know that Jace and the rest of the creative team behind Squares Air Pair did reach their goal when the Kickstarter campaign ended on June 10th. Next up, Brian and Adam talk to Anthony, one of the creative minds behind a brand new LGBT tabletop/online game called Post Republica. There's still time to back Post Republica on Kickstarter. So if you want to check out this LGBT tabletop game for yourself, head on over to their Kickstarter and go back them.
We are here with Anthony Ford. Anthony and some partners that you can talk about are doing a fantastic, really interesting sci-fi tabletop game called Post Replica. And it is on Kickstarter. I found out about it from a friend of mine who's also, I believe, one of your partners, Steven. Mm-hmm. You know, you two, I guess, are up in New York City?
That's right, New York City.
And you're in law school? Or you're just graduating law school?
We graduated today, in fact.
Wow, congratulations.
Thank you very much, yeah.
Like, I have to start with your law students, and you, I found out, had a computer science background. What, and Steven's a musician, what got you guys to get together and make a game?
Well, I mean, it all started with, Steven in a way. He was organizing a tabletop group to meet weekly at the law school as a kind of way to de-stress from our legal studies. And we found a group of people. It was Steven and I and Matthew Kennedy and Chris Asbury, two other law students. Matthew's from Utah. Chris is from Chicago. Steven's from Florida, and I'm from upstate New York. And we all came together at law school here, and we decided that we really wanted to roll up our sleeves and make something. I mean, so many times lawyers are thought of as the sort of the no person,
right,
but we really wanted to make something in law school and kind of say that we are, you know, we know what it's like, you know, to roll up our sleeves and do something.
Well, it looks like it's already a successful funding campaign on Kickstarter, and with quite a few days to go, could potentially meet a lot of your stretch goals. Tell us a little bit about Post Replica.
Yeah, so Post Replica is a hybrid tabletop online game where you play as an android who's trying to hide his or her true identity from humans who will sort of retire them upon discovery. And the online component is that androids have formed this underground railroad of support where they will help each other try to survive in this hostile world. And the online component involves a tablet in the middle of the table as you play this sort of more traditional tabletop RPG. And that app connects you to a shared world state where you have missions, rumors, information, NPCs, all being sort of updated constantly by the activities of the players of the game. And what we really want to hit on is the fact that each android feels like they have to hide their identity and they're isolated, but through this mutual support network that you get through the app, you really get this sense of community that comes out of Post Replica that we find really interesting.
Which, of course, you know, being our target audience, parallels very well with the GLBT community. Would you say that your own experience in other apps or that sense of isolated community coming together helped to influence this game or your collective experiences, I suppose?
Definitely. So, I mean, I first thought of the idea of, you know, androids as an allegory for GLBT experiences back in college when I was coming out of the closet myself. I was sort of a gay geek, and I had a really hard time, you know, coming to terms with what was my sort of programmer, you know, drummer, geeky identity going to be now that I was sort of adding this sexuality component to it. You know, who was I going to be to my friends and my family? And I thought of this game as like a perfect sort of safe parallel to that experience. I thought maybe if people played as an android and they got this experience as an outsider, they'd have empathy with my experience living in the closet and really coming to grips with who I was in a, you know, at the time, a very hostile world. Today, maybe less so, but still we have a lot of progress to make. And I thought this game would be a great way to do that. So fast forward to law school, where I meet all these really interesting, fun people, smart, talented people from all over the country, I thought, hey, maybe we can really make this game happen. And maybe now is really the right time now that we've made much more progress in our society, that this is really the time to make a game like this. I mean, there's a lot of Android fiction right now, so it sort of fits with what we're doing from a sort of, you know, a multimedia perspective, but it's also a great time for LGBT rights, and now maybe it's a great time for a game that's an allegory like this. So I sort of took one by one, I found members of my gaming group who might be kind of into this idea, and asked them to join me, and we've really come together in a great way, and we're so happy that our Kickstarter is getting some traction.
What I loved about seeing and reading up on this, I mean, the sci-fi element, of course, and the allegorical element, absolutely. I totally I remember reading back, I read a lot of Isaac Asimov and the Robots series and R. Daniel Oliva, and way back in high school, as I was coming to terms with my sexuality, that metaphor spoke very clearly to me, even though he was out as a robot. You know, he was a cyborg. People didn't or an android, I should say, and to be specific. And he, you know, was mistaken as a human sometimes, and also was out, you know, and proudly, you know, out in some other stories. So, like, that allegory is perfect. The interesting thing I found was, because I'm not the biggest tabletop, our longtime listeners will know that even though I have been dabbling lately, I played the Battlestar tabletop game. That was a lot of fun.
Were you a Cylon?
I was not the Cylon, but that was cool. I liked that element. Adam certainly is by far our tabletop expert. What you guys are doing is neat, because I'm a huge MMO fan. Like, I play Lord of the Rings, I play Old Republic, I play Final Fantasy XIV, I've played WoW, I've played, you know, whatever Asheron's Call. You guys are adding what I think will be a very appealing technological component to this. Now, it looks like the Kickstarter is basically to create to get the guidebook out and to get people playing as like a tabletop. But is the app going to be available? Well, actually, talk about what you're doing that you call it the first tablet top game. Talk about that element, and then when that component will be available.
So that's going to be available at launch, and we really think it's a kind of integral part of this experience. I'm a computer scientist, so I can do a lot of this programming myself. We have team members who have some coding experience. A lot of the backers on Kickstarter will be funding art assets and perhaps some contracted development to help us out with that. But the idea is that you still have that core tabletop RPG experience, where it's about creative and compelling storytelling, sitting around the table with your friends, rolling dice, eating snacks, having a great time. But what the tablet adds is the best parts of an MMO, which is the sense of impact on the world, the sense of community, the sense that you're part of a wider player base that's really enjoying this game and can help you achieve something that you couldn't do by yourself. And the idea that we're enhancing the tabletop experience, that creative, free kind of storytelling with technology that connects you to this wider world, where, you know, if you take on a mission from Post Replica and the person who gives you the mission dies in your story, that NPC is dead. Or if that NPC changes their tune, changes their goal, has a new relationship, you know, changes their motivation, tell us that. That's going to change that NPC for everyone else who plays the game. The idea is that what happens around your table is still this creative, interesting, fun experience, but it will have an impact on other people.
I think that sounds so exciting. I can see Wizards of the Coast and White Wolf keeping a very close eye on how successful this is going to be, and before they start incorporating the same thing into their games. But my first question that immediately jumps to mind is, will you personally be involved in the upkeep of that? Because it sounds like it's going to be very hands-on from the developers. Or are you hiring folks to do that? Like, what kind of a ongoing process will you have involved with that?
So there's two aspects to that. First is that as a sort of machine learning researcher, we're going to be developing algorithms that recombine characters, places, goals, relationships to create missions that will just dynamically populate the world. And the role of us as developers will to make sure will basically be to make sure that things don't go completely off the rails. And so you won't have, like you have in a lot of other MMOs, the same sort of tutorial quests and the same quest lines and the same stories and the same, you know, the same shopkeeper with an exclamation point over their head.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
Be constantly changing and evolving using, you know, the power of a machine learning algorithm that we're going to develop to run this app. Second aspect of this is that we're really going to be, we're going to be bringing in guest writers, and it will be a kind of microeconomy. So rather than going to the hobby shop and buying a splat book of a sort of post-replica adventure or module, you're going to be able to go into the app and pay between $1 and $5 for an adventure written by a post-replica writer that we've recruited, given a grant to, helped support, edited, and we're really hoping to reach out and find up-and-coming writers, writers from underrepresented groups, LGBT writers, writers of color, you know, people who don't necessarily have the same shot in the wider publishing environment. And it's going to be, I hope, a win-win-win to get players, you know, scripted content from outside writers that they wouldn't have an opportunity to hear from otherwise. And, you know, that's going to supplement the procedurally generated missions to give you a real sense of sort of narrative into the game.
That sounds so exciting and great outreach, great way to really build the brand. That makes me think a little bit about recently in the Steam community, the mod program. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but Skyrim was offering mods, and Steam tried to set up a system in which that would be directly linked through Steam and pay out to Bethesda. And it got major backlash because a lot of people felt the modders deserved more than a 40% cut. Was that on your mind or involved in any part of this process, or were you always looking to try to bring in, expand the talent and showcase voices as part of the repressed minority kind of theme of your game?
Yeah. We watched that story pretty closely, and it's for two reasons. One, sometimes, and we've gotten this comment on our Kickstarter, and when we're very much going to respond when we release the game with a system for this, but sometimes players want to support players, and they want to do it for free, and we think that's important. A lot of the modder community was built on the idea that because you love the game, you're going to add to the game, and you don't expect necessarily remuneration for it. What you really want is an appreciation for your craft and the opportunity to play a compelling new experience that you've had a hand in creating. So the idea of player-written stories and kind of a community of people who want to tell stories in post-replica, that's very much something we're listening to and very open to. The second part is that, you know, maybe we need to do something closer to an iTunes model, where instead of saying we're giving you 30%, what maybe you need to say is we need to post-replica or our company will take a support cost of 30%, you know, sort of flip the cost equation for writers and say, like, look, it's your story. You're the one making money off it, but we obviously need to upkeep our servers and we need to showcase you. We need to edit you. Those are costs that we're going to deduct from your revenue, but it's not like you work for us. You know, you work for the players and the idea is that we are here to support you. The whole thing is about, I mean, the whole thing about indie publishing and indie games is about the power dynamic. You know, who has the power? Is it the players and the creators, or is it the sort of corporate people behind it? And we really want to make sure that we're always responding and giving appropriate credit and credence to players and creators.
And it sounds like this is going to be an excellent opportunity for that. Obviously, story is one of the key elements to any story and setting to any tabletop gaming. And this isn't, I've played many tabletops. Some of my favorites are Scion Hero, and obviously D&D 5th edition is having great popularity. Both those games, you play the hero. And one of the themes that I picked up from your Kickstarter is that in this game, you play the anti-hero, and it's kind of the untold story and the secrecy, which again mirrors that GLBT experience. And it's nice, like you said, that you know, maybe we've still got a ways to go, but things are better than they were decades before. So it's almost like we're getting to tell stories of historical experiences now in a new format. It's great story writing. But my question is, could you tell us a little bit more about the post-replica world and setting and just the specifics of it to help some of our listeners get as excited about it as I am, because I'm very much looking forward to playing this.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So the story of post-replica is that humans achieved artificial intelligence, and they used it to create a population of androids that would do all the work for them. And humans kind of retreated to leisure. And the sort of last great thing that androids did for humans was fight this great big war. And humans were horrified because it was war without the fear of pain and death. It was war without a moral context. And they sort of shrunk back from their reliance on AI and androids. And they created this sort of global shutoff switch. They thought they could just turn it all off, go back to a simpler way of life, and walk away.
So the androids are the fighters and we're just peaceful humans now. We've turned off our armies, kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly right, right. And people thought it would be that simple. Well, 50 years go by, and it turns out just like in Jurassic Park, life finds a way. And one by one, the androids start turning back on. Some of the androids have gone crazy from the experience, and they become the sort of these twisted monsters, a sort of John Carpenter body horror situation called Buzzers. And those are the sort of monsters of the game. And the ones that come back and they're still sapient and alert are the players. And they awaken to a world that no longer needs or wants them, a world that would sort of retire them upon discovery. And they have to take that experience of being forced to be an outsider, and they have to meet adversity with grace. They have to decide, you know, what is the greater purpose of my life if I'm not going to be the hero who gets all the credit at the end? So there's sort of two major opponents in post-replica. One is these fellow androids who've gone twisted and crazy, and they give humans a justification for hating androids. So you could go out and sort of stop these buzzers because you just want a better rep for android kind, or you could do it to protect humans. You know, your motives are up to you. And on the other hand are the humans themselves. They've set up this kind of standing inquisition called the Reclaimers, and they want to reclaim Earth for humanity only. And they're going around doing these sort of voight comp tests, to use the term from Blade Runner, and they're trying to expose you. And you've got to outsmart them, outwit them. You know, they're the sort of order opponent, while the buzzers are the sort of chaos opponent. And you stand between these two poles, and you have to decide, how am I going to meet these challenges in the world?
It sounds like such a great setup for story writing. Like, immediately, my mind's filled with ideas. One of the key things that it seems to be setting up is android versus android violence or competition. Like you said, them being the first front and the humans being the perhaps not intentionally adversarial, just misunderstanding for the players. Let's talk a little bit about the parallels with the GLBT community and infighting. And I think that probably is meant to be an aspect to this story as well. Is that the case?
Definitely true. And as we've played playtests with players, I used the word play too much there. Sorry about that.
I love games. That's fine.
Yeah. As we have players around the table, we will always find one player who says, you know, we have to hide, we have to survive, we have to lay low, you know, we just have to do what we need to do to get along. Then we have another player, it's always one other player, who says, forget it, we are better than this. We can just go out and do whatever we want, doesn't matter what the humans think, we're going to go fight the monsters, whatever we want to do, no limits. And then there's this kind of majority that swings back and forth between those two power forces, you know. And in a lot of ways, I mean, it speaks to the early history of LGBT activism in America. There was this sort of gay power movement that said, you know, we don't have to sit down and take this. We can take to the streets and demand rights. And then there was the more, you know, sort of civil disobedience at the most, the sort of peaceful advocacy movement that said, hey, let's use the legal system. Let's find great plaintiffs. Let's bring these cases. Let's do lobbying. And in a lot of ways, that's what we have today, is sort of mainstream LGBT activism. But there is, I think, still a kind of queer power idea. And maybe we shouldn't be so quick to walk away from the idea of demanding dignity from the society we've spent decades supporting, even in a thankless way. And there's, you know, very intentional. The idea that when you get people around a table and now they're talking about androids and you immediately see these factions form. I mean, it's no surprise that that exactly echoes, you know, what we see in our own history as the LGBT rights movement.
Exactly. And that's what I think is going to make it so resonant, not just with the community, but for other players to get that aha moment as they face those consequences and to their actions and those moral dilemmas within your game system. It sounds so, so exciting.
Now, I'm looking through the Kickstarter page and also the article that you shared with us on Gamer XP. If you guys want to check gamer-xp.com, if you guys go, if our listeners will go check out that article, we'll post it up on Facebook. Between the two, there's a lot of great art. And I was curious, I see here you have some more of your team members. Who is the main artistic talent that does a lot of the sketches? And is it a group of you, or, you know, tell us a little bit about some of the other components of this group and what they bring to the project.
Yeah, so we've contracted with two concept artists. One is named Doug Hills, and the other one is Samuel Alexander. Samuel Alexander is going to stay on, and he's going to become one of our lead interior artists for the rulebook. A lot of the Kickstarter budget is going to be for more art, and we, of course, want to reach out to other artists and bring in more styles. As far as our, I want to say, look and feel or sort of design vision, we have Chris Asbury, who's one of our founders, and he's a very talented artist. And I think that he has a lot more to give when it comes to, you know, what is the art direction of Post Replica. But I'm very open. From my perspective, it's really all about exciting people with this idea and then challenging them to give it a look. You know, getting this idea in their head, getting the bug in their ear, and people will always surprise you. And I'm so open to that. So Sam Alexander is going to stay on the team, and I'm so excited about that. But we are, of course, going to be recruiting other artists to add to this game.
It looks, I mean, the art looks great. It's very stylized. And I see one of your stretch goals is also to do a graphic novel. And I could totally see this world lending itself to some great storytelling outside of the gaming community, certainly, or inside the gaming community, of course, but outside as well, to really capture people's attention and bring them back to the game. So you guys met your main goal, so that's awesome, and it looks like you're doing quite well to, I don't know, hit at least one of your stretch goals. When do you see this actually, like, launching? What is your target date for this getting out into the world?
Our target date is the holiday season of 2015, so sometime in December.
Wow, that's very ambitious.
Of course, I mean, it's my nature to be ambitious. You know, if I had done this, by myself, and I had, just done whatever my genius said, you know, to use the Roman version of that word. That sounds so pretentious, but...
No, it's fine. We understand.
Whatever the inspiration told me to do. I would have had a Kickstarter in January, and it would have failed. But what I've done instead is I've really tried to recruit a team that brings a lot of complementary strengths to what my idea is and really help us all succeed. And they are the ones that really, you know, Matt, Chris, Steven, Sam, Elise, our PR specialist, Kira, our coder, you know, they really helped me scope out this project and think about what it takes to actually do a successful Kickstarter. And, you know, they may come back and say, you know, this project can't be done by December, and that's okay. You know, that's life. That's part of a creative project. No one has made this kind of game before, and I don't say that in a way to pat myself on the back. I just say it in a way, you know, to just be realistic. You know, we have to scope out what is the first version of the app going to be and what is the level of rulebook that it's going to take to really get people excited about this story. I feel like if everything goes according to plan, we can do it by the holiday season. But I'm not upset if we miss that deadline. You know, it's not a deadline. It's a, you know, it's a optimistic goalpost. Let's say it that way.
And I think you've certainly, the way you've set this Kickstarter up, you're very good about laying out your plan. You know, I love that you guys actually go into your budget and some of the things that so many projects don't. Mm-hmm. And you, so I would believe then that going forward, once the project is really being developed, you would be very upfront with the backers and say, hey guys, look, here's what's coming. This will be delayed, but you know, da 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 da. Like, you know, like any responsible Kickstarter project should these days
right.
do.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think that I, being in software myself, you know, I know the perils and sometimes over optimism, and I'm not saying that's what this is here, because honestly I don't know. I'm really the computer science programmer part of me is like really curious about your platform, and I want to talk code, but that's not for this show.
I think we're both looking forward to becoming backers so we can keep up with your updates as you post them.
Absolutely, very much so.
One of the questions I had just to kind of to wrap up is some of the we actually mentioned Asimov earlier. But one of the aspects of this game that's so exciting is it's very futurist. And I just wanted to give you an opportunity to speak to that, in that the world that you're envisioning has the potential to come true, perhaps in 50, 150 years. Is there an aspect to getting our population thinking about that possible eventuality and what we would want to do as a species, as humanity, for facing emerging AI later in our possible existence?
That's a great question. So when I worked for the Air Force, one of the things I would often talk with my colleagues about is, you know, AI is essentially inevitable. Where do you want it to come from? Do you want it to come from a, you know, repressive autocratic government? Do you want it to come from a, you know, purely greedy and money-making entity, or do you want it to come from the bastion of freedom in the world? And my pitch would always be, look, if we're going to make AI, I think the Air Force or maybe the Navy, not that we compete in a friendly way, we should make it. We should do it first. You know, it should be the next moon landing to achieve AI in a democratic, progressive, humanist, forward-looking, and ultimately generous society. And, you know, I really hope that, you know, what happens in Post-Replica will make people sit in the shoes of the kind of characters that would exist if it all went wrong. And what I hope people will learn is that we can really do this right, whether it's LGBT issues, whether it's just thinking about empathizing with an outsider, or whether it's, you know, literally AI. We should really be thinking about how do we deal with people who are different from us, and how do we incorporate them into a truly pluralistic society, not in a way that has to go all wrong before we fix it, but in a way that goes right the first time. And I think there's so many lessons to be learned from, you know, both civil rights battles from a race perspective, a gender perspective, and a sexuality and gender identity perspective, that we really could, if we sat and thought about it, we could do this right the first time in the next big issues we face. One of them might be AI, could be a variety of other things.
No, I think you're spot on about that. I mean, it certainly feels like those that can should help guide the conversation, you know. And I'm thrilled to see with the sort of more cyborg, you know, Ray Kurzweil sort of, you know, us melding together in the, well, if he's right in the next 20 years, but, you know, seeing more and more technology become part of our lives and in integrated ways, it just seems like that's the signpost that's showing us, hey, look, someday parts of our lives will be automated and they'll be robotic or they'll be AI. You know, I mean, Google Now and Siri and Cortana, which is kind of funny.
And Alexa on my countertop these days.
Oh, I didn't know about that.
Amazon Echo.
Wow. Oh, that's right.
Oh, she's
like,
smart.
These are base sort of AI agents, like they've been predicting forever and doing little tasks that you want them to do. They may not be going off into the internet and doing, you know, little away missions for you like I think some people thought agents were going to do. But, you know, certainly they're helpful and providing a type of autonomy that gives us a benefit as the you know, person with that agent. So it's just a matter of time.
Yeah, I think you're right to note that it's really about identity. It's not necessarily about technology. I mean, all the ethicists who've been talking to this point, and Ray Kurzweil is kind of one of them. It's really about, oh, you know, what are we going to do about this technology? It's what are we going to do about ourselves? Because our identity will be changed by this technology. And playing games like Post Replica, I hope people really question, you know, what is identity? You know, people will play Post Replica in a playtest and they'll be like, oh, I really see the humanity in these android characters. Well, what does that mean? I mean, you're playing a character that's utterly not human, who's a counterpoint to humanity itself. But you're saying you have humanity. Why is that? You really have to think and reflect on what are the qualities that stay with us, you know, what changes. And when we start incorporating Cortana into our daily lives, I mean, where does Cortana end and where do we begin? We don't even know how to ask that question yet.
Exactly. Yeah. So the Kickstarter is still up, and it's up for, well, as of the recording, 21 days. So we have certainly some time coming before this. When you hear this, it will still be going. And even though, like I said, you guys have met your main goal, there is still plenty of stretch goal to go. So if you guys go to Kickstarter and you look for Post Replica, you will find them. And we'll link it up on our Facebook and, you know, put it out on Twitter and all the usual social media outlets. And Anthony, thank you so much for sitting down. Again, tell Stephen that I personally am sorry I didn't get to talk to him and then the rest of the team, of course, as well. And once this game gets closer to launch, maybe we could even have you back on and discuss, you know, how things are going. You know, Adam and I were talking before we started recording. We'd love to even record this in some format. You know,
yeah, we would love to do a play episode of this. When you guys are ready, we'll bring our whole group to get together and we'll see where we go.
We've had this joke / thing we've been toying with, and again, our listeners who've been around for a while, 40K, not 40K Warhammer, but 40K. We've toyed with the idea of doing a sort of tabletop story thing. So this actually could be a perfect vehicle for that kind of thing. So yeah, we're really excited. I'll definitely go out and back this. I haven't yet. And
we're gonna race as soon as we're
done. We're gonna race to go back. But again, thank you so much for sitting down. We really appreciate it. And again, that's Post Replica. Company is Rational Basis Media. And if you just go on Kickstarter, you guys will find it. Do you have any other web presence or any other social media presence you want to mention?
Yeah, if you go to kickstarter.postreplica.com, it'll take you right to the Kickstarter page.
Perfect.
Okay, that's awesome. That's an easy way to just type it into your address box. We're on Twitter as Rational Base, BAS. We're on Facebook, Rational Basis Media. You can always follow me. I'm Ant Ford, and I will always direct you to what we're up to. You know, postreplica.com, rationalbasismedia.com. Chris has done a great job of just making us very reachable. So,
well, congratulations again on your graduation today. To you and your team. You guys, it's an amazing story, and we look forward to being in it.
Oh, for sure. And thank you so much for having us on. I'm so happy that we were able to get on a podcast like this and really reach out to the community that, I mean, makes me happy as a creator to know is out there. And I wish I could just go back in time and tell college-aged Anthony, you know, it, you're going to find a bunch of gay geeks who just love the things you love.
Absolutely. I feel the same way about my younger self. Well, again, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
All right, guys, that does it for this month's episode of Flame On. If you want to go check out any of the work that these creators have done, check us out on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Flame On Show. You can find us on the Twitter, the Instagram, the RSS feed. There's a whole bunch of things you can check us out on. But make sure you do show some love to these creators and the work that they've done. Check out Square's Pair once it comes out if you weren't one of the Kickstarter backers. And there's still time. Make sure that you give Post Republica a couple of your dollars if you are into tabletop gaming. Follow us online. Send us some feedback. We love to hear from you guys. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to Flame On, a podcast made possible by Powder Milk Biscuits, the ones in the blue box, a comic shop, and the generous support of tops and bottoms like you. If you want to be one of our sugar daddies, you can help out by telling a cute single friend about us, reviewing us on iTunes, or putting some dollars down our digital G-string in our monthly support drive. For more ridiculously entertaining and socially enlightening episodes of Flame On, as well as other fine programs, head on over to nerdyshow.com. You can subscribe to Flame On and all Nerdy Show Network podcasts via iTunes. And be sure to find us on Twitter at Flame On Podcast or Facebook on our Flame On fan page. And make sure to check out flameonshow.com for more nerdy queer in your ear.